Okay, we are now doing audio recording, and I will now do a mute all. And again, everybody does have the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so or use the chat window. And just as I, in case I miss it later on, Bob Walker is going to be giving a presentation tonight towards the end of the evening. He has posted into the chat window all of the URLs that are in his deck for tonight. So if you want to pick them up from there, be a little bit easier, and you can do it right now. So welcome, folks, to the January 5th Q&A, our first Q&A of the year. And we have a pretty full agenda. If you have any questions or additional items, we may have some time towards the end of the evening, but you can always put it into the chat window, and I know a lot of people monitor the chat and might be able to help you out. Otherwise, if you don't get your item covered this week, by all means, send to suggestion box at opcug.ca, and we will put it in the queue for our next Q&A, which will be 2 weeks out from tonight, because next week will be our general meeting, so we won't have a Q&A there. With that, I'll kick it over to Alan to take us through tonight's deck.
Thanks, Chris, and Happy New Year to everyone. And we'll start off right away with a follow-up from last week. I'd said that I wasn't aware of any free Canadian tax programs. And in the chat window, which everybody monitors, you probably all saw then that Tristan posted about Simple Tax, which is now actually called Wealth Simple Tax. And so this is a, I think this is an online system. It's for Canadian income tax. And it's basically a free program in terms of you can pay what you can, and that includes, as the website says, even $0. So if you want to try doing your income tax with a free program, this is certainly a possibility. Our next slide is a slide from me. The next item is about scams. And today I spent most of the day updating one of my friend's computers, like refreshing Windows, because she'd fallen victim to this Microsoft tech support scam where the pop-up message comes on the screen and you're full of viruses and you're going to be infected and all manner of bad things are going to happen. And you should call this number, call Microsoft at this number. And sure enough, a Microsoft technical expert answers the phone and shows you all the viruses you have and takes your $300 from your credit card sometimes. And sometimes they even get remote control access to the machine, which is why I was trashing Windows and basically rebuilding it from scratch. So I really want everybody to tell all your friends and relatives that, A, they should have an image backup of their system so that they can recover from this stuff really quickly, like in 30 minutes. And secondly, that Microsoft do not put phone numbers on error messages that pop up on screens. So if that happens, it's not Microsoft, and they should call you to verify what's going on. And with that, we'll move on to Scam of the Week. Chris has some information.
Yeah, this was forwarded into the suggestion box email address about KnowBe4, which is a security company that does penetration testing and things like that, and a lot of things that are around social engineering to scam people. And this one came up. This is a little bit of a mix from the one that was actually sent in, but Omicron right now is really big in the news, and there's a lot of scammers that are taking advantage of that. And one of the phishing emails stated, this letter is to inform that you've been exposed to a coworker who tested positive. Please take a look at details in the attached document. So if you opened up the attached document, which was an Excel document, and it would, of course, prompt you to enable macros, and then their device would be infected with a banking Trojan. And just as a side note on it, in a poor attempt at humor, the document then displayed a pop-up showing the COVID-19 funeral assistance helpline phone number. So the URL is pasted into the chat window and is there. And you can actually subscribe to their blog at the at that page. And if you want to get these come out periodically and get them sent to your email address automatically, feel free to do so. And next, so another resource that you have available to you, and tell all your friends that it's available to them as well, is the ROPC User Group's Fraud Watch webpage. And it's a great place to get familiar with the types of scams that are out there and discover other resources that can help you out. So I highly encourage people to visit that. We do periodically add content to that. We try to limit it to items that are new and don't resemble something that we have already flagged. There's not a lot of benefit to just flooding you with endless ones that are basically the same scam. And if anybody has scams that they've come across that are unique or something novel about them that don't match something already on the Fraud Watch page, by all means, send it in. I would suggest a screenshot of things and an explanation as to what makes it unique and what people should watch out for.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And our next item is a follow-up on Chris's President's Report, which you probably saw in the current newsletter, talking about presentations at the Ottawa Public Library. And Linda Buskey, our official pollster, has a whole bunch of updates on the numbers, I guess.
Okay, and a statistician.
Thanks, Alan. So, yeah, when I read the President's Report, it was absolutely true. There was a big drop in the number of presentations, but I didn't think it told the whole story. So I wanted to dig into the numbers a little bit more. So Chris did provide me with some of the raw data, and I just played around a bit. So next slide, Alan, please. So, yes, there was a drop in the number of presentations. And prior to March of 2020, they were all in person. Then there was a period in 2020 where it was just shut completely. And then all the presentations after May of 2020 were via the video conference. And you can see the numbers do drop. Next. But the good news is the number of presentations dropped, but attendance was actually up. And I thought this was a very important metric because we actually were able to reach 630 attendees. We had 630 attendees to the presentations in 2021, which has been our highest in the last 4 years. Those are the blue bars that track that. But the yellow line is the attendees per presentation. So you can see once we started doing the virtuals, the average number of people obviously could be any number, and we were averaging about 50. So that was much higher than some of the presentations in earlier years where you might only get 4 or 5 people show up. So while, you know, I don't miss driving from the East End to Kanata, you know, in a snowstorm or during rush hour or whatever for 5 people, I don't miss that part. But there are things about the in-person that I do miss. I miss seeing people's faces and seeing when they're lost. I miss seeing when they get it. I miss them laughing at my jokes because they're not muted. So there's lots of advantage to the face-to-face, but there's lots of advantages to the virtual too. So next slide, please. So the actual number of topics went down a little bit, and that's because, I mean, the Ottawa Public Library chooses the topics. Chris provides the whole suite of lectures that we have in the can type thing, and they pick and choose. And they're often looking for new material, and we don't always have new content. So I think the fact that we haven't plummeted on that, so that's good. So just down a bit. Next one. But we had more presenters, which was interesting. So when I look at the number of presenters in 2021, we were up to 5. And I think part of that is because it was virtual. So people like Bob Walker, who it's a long run back into town to come in to present to a few people. But we had Bob virtually. We had Alan virtually, who's Far East End like me. We had Lawrence from Alexandria. So the fact that the virtual did actually help our number of presenters. And next slide. I think that's it. Yep, perfect. Thank you.
Yeah, so thank you very much. That's great. That the number of attendees, that graph is certainly very telling. Just amazing.
Yes.
Okay, moving along then, we go to some favorite Android apps, and Tom Trottier has a couple of mapping apps. Tom?
Yes, hi.
This is Maps.me is an app that downloads its maps beforehand. It uses Open Maps, and it has some of the maps it uses as well. It has routing and so on. And the maps vary. They seem to run between, depending on the size of the country or state or province or partial, somewhere between 50 and 500 megabytes. So it does put a hit on your phone. On the other hand, they're with you. You don't need any local data access. You don't need any roaming access. And you can delete the maps and load them in as you wish. So it's very nice. You can do this sort of thing with Google Maps, but it's more fussy. You have to download them ahead of time. This will also Maps.me will also automatically download maps for you and keep them updated if you wish. And you can also delete them. So you can delete them. You can load them up for a particular place you're going to and delete them when you come home. So it's very convenient. They have lots of, not just the streets and so on, but they have a lot of points of interest and so on that are nice. So it's you can try it out and delete it. It's a free app, so have fun with it. Any questions?
Don't see anything yet, Tom.
And Strava. I usually turn this on. I have it on my my watch as well as my phone, and I use it for tracking walks and bike rides. It can show graphs and so on of your heart rate, distance, speed. It can show your route on a map, and it can feed information to Google Fit if you're keeping track of your fitness and your efforts towards fitness as you go along. It is, if you pay for the pro version of it, then it gives you a lot more information for cycling. It's the go-to app for cyclists to compare themselves on different routes. You can on the pro one and the free one, you can follow professional cyclists or friends and so on and see what they've been doing lately, or you know, how you measure up to them and so on. So it's a social app for cyclists especially. But you can use it for walking, running. I just use it for biking. Are there any questions?
You have another slide.
Here's my my afternoon ride. It doesn't actually. It only apparently it turned out it ran out of steam, or I forgot to turn it on. But it shows me going down to the library, and then going to Loblaws, and then going to physiotherapy. So. and so is 6 kilometers and so on, and these are the graphs that this is the heart rate graph. So I wasn't doing a lot, but I was doing some. The max speed is probably going downhill on the bridge from Rideau Canal.
So Natalie's suggesting that maybe you should download a bigger area in case you venture further out.
Oh, the maps are, you can zoom them in or out. You can, for maps.me, the areas that you download are basically either, I think there's like 4 maps for Ontario, like there's one for Toronto, one for Eastern Ontario, one for Southwestern Ontario, and one for Northern Ontario. So the, you can, download whatever maps you want, and it's around the world. I haven't checked Antarctica, but Africa, Asia, there are maps for everywhere basically, except perhaps China, which is very upset about people mapping them except for themselves.
Okay.
Are there any questions on Strava?
Nothing in the chat.
Okie dokes.
Oh, wait a minute. it's Glenn says, does Strava require a mobile connection to track?
I don't know. I've always had a mobile connection. I imagine that it doesn't, but obviously you're going to need a connection at some point to upload or download. I don't know whether it requires a mobile connection. Sorry.
Yeah, it may not. I use a walking program called WalkMeter, and once you've downloaded the map, it just uses the GPS to track. Okay, so moving along, Chris has got some information on some fantastic prices on flash drives.
Yeah, I came across some information about suspicious flash drives, and I started looking around, and if you go to Amazon Canada, you can find a 1 terabyte flash drive for $13 or $15.99, or you can even get a 2 terabyte flash drive for $20. And if you go to eBay Canada, they're even cheaper. You can get a 2 terabyte for $9.60 Canadian, or you can even get them as cheap as $5.28. So fantastic deals. Unfortunately, they're all fake. Okay. If we look at what a legitimate 1 terabyte flash drive should actually cost you, if we look at CDW, which is a reputable company here in Canada, or Best Buy Canada, you can see that, for going for a 1 terabyte flash drive, you're looking at about $230 is what you should be spending. So they are fake. Now, next slide. If we look at flash drives, there are two components on a flash drive. There's main components on there. So there's the actual storage, the memory, and then there's a controller chip. And your computer has no idea about the capacity of that flash drive at all. It talks to the controller. Unfortunately, the controller can be programmed to say anything it wants to, or the programmer wants it to say. So if the storage capacity is actually less than what the controller says is on there, your computer will happily send the data, and then the controller has a couple of options to it. It can say it wrote the data and just discard it. And what the end result of that would be that the initial stuff that you write to the drive that fit into the memory that was actually there would still be there. And so if you look at some file that you created on that flash drive, when you first plugged it in and wrote some stuff to it, they'd look perfectly fine. Another thing it could do is overwrite the data that is in storage that actually exists on the flash drive. And in that case, you would always see the latest data that you copied to the drive. So if you copy a file and then you read that one file back, as long as that one file didn't exceed the capacity of the flash drive, it would actually read it back all fine. So basically it has those two ways that it could deal with the fact that it's lying to you. So the solution to this is, first off, if you see an unrealistically low price, it's guaranteed to be fake. So if you go onto Amazon Canada and you buy a 2 terabyte flash drive and it only costs you $20, I can guarantee you that it's a fake flash drive. You are going to have problems with it. However, if there is a realistic price to it, that's not necessarily a guarantee that it's a legitimate drive. Some of the vendors have actually been boosting their prices. In one case, just so they can make more money. In another case, it actually looks more legitimate. So if you see one that's a 1 terabyte drive and it's $100, you think, well, it was going to cost me $230 at Best Buy. Yeah, buying it on Amazon, maybe there are some legitimate drives, flash drives, that it's only $100. So they might fake you out that way. So the thing to do is to buy from a reputable brand and buy from a reputable vendor and then test it. So there are a number of options out there for testing. So what you want to do is use a program that is designed to actually detect fake flash drives. What they do is they write data across the entire device, and then they read the data back off of the device. So if the drive says it's 1 terabyte, they will try to write 1 terabyte worth of data to that device and then read the data back and see if they get it back okay. So there is a website there that 11 freeware applications that can detect fake USB flash drives, SD cards, and SSDs. There are programs there for Windows, Linux, and macOS. And if you want to see a video that explains a little bit better than I have probably in terms of exactly what the problem is and how you go about doing the testing, there's a URL to a YouTube video. And he actually uses one of the ones that's on that 11 freeware list, H2 TestW, to actually do his testing. And so I highly recommend that if you're going for large capacity flash drives, test them and make sure that you're getting what you're paying for. And that's it.
Hey, thanks, Chris. Tom mentions that often the controller will map a real 4 megabytes multiple times, and check disk isn't enough to sort that out. He also says you can return free for a full refund on Amazon or get a full refund from eBay without returning.
Yeah. One of the things that you have to watch for, I think, is in particular with Amazon, I only buy stuff from Amazon that ships from Amazon because I know that returning anything that goes back to Amazon is brain dead easy. They pay for the shipping to go back and so forth. If you buy it and it ships from somebody else, then you're going to have to return it to that third party. And who knows if they're as trustworthy as Amazon is when it comes to returns. I don't have experience myself with eBay returning stuff to there. So.
And Amazon now has a return store, or third parties take Amazon returns and sell them off. So you could go and buy one of these fake 1 terabyte drives for $20.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Tom mentions there too that a brand name one can be fake as well. True, and that's why beyond just saying a reputable brand, I say a reputable vendor as well. It's not to say that reputable vendors haven't been tricked into selling fake stuff, but that's about as best as I can recommend, and then test afterwards to verify that it is actually the full capacity that you pay for.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So that's something to watch out for, I guess. So the next thing we've got is my abandoning, or perhaps abandoning Windows one of these days and moving full-time to Linux. And I've got my list of, my to-do list, as it were, of all the Windows software that I use, and I've been looking for alternatives. And the last item on the list there is a very special program. And I'm certainly not the only person in Ottawa that uses this software, but I bet I'm the only person on this call tonight that does so. And it's a crash data retrieval tool from Bosch, the German electronics company. And basically, let's just talk for a minute about computers that are onboard motor vehicles these days. You all know that your vehicle has lots of computers on board. And the reason you can't buy a brand new vehicle right now is because there are no chips available for the manufacturers to stuff into all these microprocessors. It turns out one of these, or several of these modular computers on the vehicle are actually crash recorders. And the generic name for those was event data recorders, because they can also record things like hard braking events and run off road and that kind of thing, as opposed to an actual physical collision. And why do we need this? Well, here's a fairly spectacular front end crash, and you can see that the airbag has deployed. And the question is, why did it deploy, and when did it deploy is even more critical. Why it deployed is not hard to figure out in this case, because there's so much damage, and you know that's a, you look at that left A pillar, just by the side of the windshield there, it's starting to straighten up. And that means that it's seeing something like 48 kilometer per hour equivalent barrier velocity. So it's a pretty severe crash, and I expect the airbag's definitely going to deploy in that. The problem is the early airbags, we're talking about the kind of early 80s, manufacturers in North America were installing airbags in all the vehicles, but they had incredibly low threshold for deployment, and they were really aggressive when they deployed, and very fast and very powerful. And it was a problem. And it was a huge problem for mainly little kids in the US, although we did have some fatalities in Canada and amongst certain populations, short females and again, children. And one of the problems here was in the States especially, the bags were designed for unbelted 50th percentile male American drivers. And we've got a completely different situation in Canada. Everybody's belted. We just need airbags to be kinder and gentler and give supplemental head protection against hitting the steering wheel. If you have an aggressive airbag that deploys very rapidly, the problem can be the driver hits the brakes, the child's unrestrained, he slides forward on the seat, puts his nose on the dashboard, and then they hit the other car, and the airbag deploys with great force, and you end up with a fatally, or you can end up with a fatally injured child. So what can you do about that? Well, the airbag's controlled by what they call a sensing and diagnostic module. So there's an accelerometer on board the vehicle, and the SDM is monitoring the vehicle acceleration. And when it sees something that it thinks is a crash, then it enables a control mechanism that starts deploying things and fires the airbag. The little microprocessor that looks up to see what kind of crash it's in has some spare memory. So one of the things the automotive engineers did was they used that spare memory to store some information about the collision. So here's the setup. You've got the silver box over on the right here is the actual sensing and diagnostic module, which has been taken out of the vehicle. This is an electronic interface, which is produced. It's a crash data retrieval system. And it basically hooks into the electronics of the box and then feeds the information to the computer. And we've got some software in here that can read the data. And of course, the data is stored as hexadecimal. So now we need a program to interpret this hex data for us and tell us what's going on in the crash. So in your vehicle today, you've got crash recorders, which will tell people things like this. And you get a whole list of information about what's going on in the collision. I just pick out a few of the variables here. You can see that the maximum delta V, the maximum change in velocity in this crash for the vehicle, was 48 kilometers per hour. So the vehicle slowed down by 48 clicks in this crash. The driver's side airbag deployed in 38 milliseconds, so that's faster than the blink of an eye. And you'll also notice that the switches on the seatbelt, which are monitored, and we know that those seatbelts are fastened, so the driver and passenger are both wearing the seatbelt system. Here's the delta V pulse. So now we're looking at the change in velocity, kilometers per hour on the right here, against milliseconds from time zero. And you can see that even though this is a 48 kilometer per hour pulse, might not be obvious to you, but it takes almost 250 milliseconds for the vehicle to kind of slow down, which in my money, this is a fairly soft crash pulse. It's still severe, but it takes a fair amount of time to decelerate. And so that's what I would consider to be a soft pulse. If that vehicle had hit a brick wall, and this is an actual crash test, which one of my colleagues used to run. So we're starting off at 48 kilometers per hour. We're dropping down to zero, and we're doing that in 100 milliseconds. So that's half of the time that we saw before. And now the vehicle, the delta V is starting to rise, which means that the vehicle is rebounding from the wall. So this is a pretty hard crash pulse and a big delta V in a fairly short time frame. So we get a good idea of crash severity from this crash pulse. Now, the other thing that the recorder captures is pre-crash data. And so, for example, here we can see that 5 seconds before the crash, this vehicle, this particular vehicle, was doing 91 kilometers per hour. the guy was off the brakes until the last second before the crash, then he hit the brakes, and he slowed down to about 70 kilometers per hour when he hit whatever he hit. So it's giving us some information about driver actions and the performance of various safety features on the vehicle for collision avoidance. And one of the things, one of the interesting things that tells you is we had a lot of complaints of unintended acceleration. People would say they had their foot hard on the brake and the engine was racing and the vehicle took off and they ran into something. Well, all these cases right here are people who said exactly that. They had their foot hard on the brake and the vehicle accelerated and it was out of control. Well, the green is people pressing on the accelerator pedal and the red is people pressing on the brake. So it's pretty obvious that the people who say they were hard on the brake were actually hard on the accelerator. And that's why the thing was running away from them. So you can't hide the facts anymore. Now you have even more sensing systems in the vehicle. So here you can see that we're monitoring the rotation of the steering wheel. So the driver's input, the driver is steering to the right initially, greater and greater, and then the steering gets less and less. So now he's steering to the left, and now he's steering hard to the left. So there's some kind of collision avoidance maneuvers going on here in addition to whatever braking actions he's taking. And now we have advanced driver assistance systems. You've got a lot of electronic systems, adaptive cruise control, automatic braking systems, pedestrian detection, lane keeping assistance systems. And again, all these things are being monitored. So here you can see a recent vehicle which has forward collision warning system, which a second and a half before the crash engaged or gave a warning, and the pre-crash braking system, the automatic braking system, kicked in. It was engaged. So a lot of information here for vehicle safety researchers and automotive engineers who can find out what goes on in crashes and hopefully can make vehicles safer. So that's my vehicle safety research hat. So the question is whether these things are black boxes and are spying on nice drivers. And Linda will tell you that 80% of people believe that they're better than average drivers. And so some people might be concerned, but if you're better than average driver, then it's going to be the other guy's fault. So if the box will pin the blame on him, then you're doing pretty well. But for vehicle safety research, these things, in my view, are silver bullets because you get tremendous amount of safety information from these systems. So all that to say that I use this crash data retrieval software to take a look at what these things are telling me. It's a Windows program, but you recall that we can drive Windows programs in Wine. So here I'm trying to install, using Wine, I'm trying to install the CDR software. And of course, this is another instance where it blows up and it's trying to find this link library and it doesn't work. And so it blows up and it's unable to register the library system here. And so my program isn't going to work in Linux. So, and this is a huge problem because it won't run under Wine. And there is no other, there's no Linux version of this software. And there's no other package that I could possibly use because it's proprietary data and from Bosch. There's no other system I can use. So this is going to be a big red X like it was for Taxman. Although now we've got Well Simple Tax, I guess I can do my Canadian income tax using that program. But certainly the crash data retrieval system, I've got no option but to use Windows. But you notice I've still got a couple of question marks there. I've still got some arrows in my bow here, or arrows in my quiver, that I think I'm going to be able to run these programs kind of in Linux. And we'll come back to that next time we chat about abandoning Windows. Okay, I noticed a whole bunch of stuff in the chat window, but I don't know what it was all about.
Yeah, just some comments on things like best to have your seat as far back as you can. When deployed, the airbags can cause a lot of harm. You should not be putting up your feet on the dashboard when riding shotgun. And that looks like it in terms of the material for that.
And just to add to that, the whole point of that research was to try and get rid of these aggressive airbags. And what we have now, we went from the original first generation airbags to a depowered airbag, which was called second generation, so less powerful systems. And now we have advanced airbag systems. So you have multi-stage inflators. You can have a low level, a mid level, a high level, and much more discriminating in terms of when to deploy the airbag, dual threshold system. So they will deploy more rapidly for unbelted and less often if people are belted. And generally these advanced systems these days are pretty benign and give really good protection in combination with the seatbelt. So people shouldn't be worried about it anymore. And they are actually really good safety systems.
And I think Tristan has given away your secret as to what you're going to be coming up with, I suspect, with what you're going to do with your crash data retrieval tool. But we'll leave that for another night. Just before we turn it over to Bob for his presentation, Bob's is the last one that we have pre-planned. I did get a call today from Pamela Robinson, who was having some issues with her voice over IP, and she was looking for some assistance. So I think we'll have time to handle her issue. So anybody who is using voice over IP, if you can think about advice that you might be able to provide in terms of good providers, bad providers, or anything else, keep that in mind as we come out of the Bob's presentation, which I believe is next.
Yeah, so now, Bob, it's your time to share your screen and tell us all about browsers and browser settings for privacy.
And Bob, you're muted. And I hope we haven't lost him. Bob, you there? You're muted currently. No, I think we might have lost them.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you now, Bob.
Okay, let me just get the presentation up here, The Wonders of Modern Technology. Okay, you see my first slide there?
Yes, we do.
Okay, good. Okay, so we started a mini-series last week on privacy on the Internet. And last week we looked at why you might want or need to guard your privacy online. And this week we'll start with the how by looking at browsers and basic browser privacy settings. Now, keep in mind that your desire or need for privacy on the Internet is up to you and your tolerance for having others know more about you than you might like them to have. And like last week, I'll be covering just the tip of the iceberg on this. and pointing you towards where you can get for more information. Online privacy is a major concern in the tech world, and by far the biggest privacy issues arise when you browse the internet. And why that is because online marketers of all stripes are keen to monetize you by following you around the web and tracking your browser activity and your browser cookies, your IP address, and other device-specific identifiers. So your browser is one of your biggest vulnerabilities here. We'll cover some of the ways you can be tracked in a future Q&A, but the right browser properly set up can protect you against some privacy and tracking infringements. Some of the things about browsers, the private browsing mode, sometimes called incognito or in private or simply private, doesn't really protect you against tracking. The private browsing mode usually only hides your activities from your local machine's history so that people with access to your device, like your boss or your parents, can't see where you've been on the web. In most browsers, private mode doesn't share cookies with the regular browsing mode. And when you exit the private mode, it discards all the cookies you downloaded once you close it. We're going to cover some of the ways you can be tracked in a future Q&A, but the right browser properly set up can guide against some privacy and tracking infringements. Oops, I think I'm repeating myself here. Okay, there's a setting in many browsers called Do Not Track, and this was supposed to be an easy way of opting out of tracking. And sort of like the National Do Not Call Registry was supposed to be an easy way of getting out of telemarketing calls, but unfortunately both efforts have really failed to deliver on what they promised. Part of the problem is there's no enforcement for this Do Not Track. Any website can choose to honor your setting or ignore it. And you don't really know whether they're doing this or not. So we need to take other steps to limit tracking. It should be noted that Do Not Track was a Firefox invention, and in no time, the folks at Google had figured out a way around it. Some of the browsers do a better job than others at guarding your privacy, and we're going to have a look at some of them. Most of the information I'm going to tell you tonight comes from these URLs, and I've already loaded those into the chat window before the meeting, so they're available there, or if you download the deck, they're in the deck here. One of the main articles here, the top article, was from PC Magazine, and their testing was done using the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Cover Your Tracks tool. Now, in future presentations, we're going to look at tracking, and we'll have a closer look at this tool because you can use it yourself with your own computer. But it covers a lot of the information we're going to be talking about tonight. Other than Firefox, Tor, and Safari, most browsers, including Microsoft Edge, are based on a custom version of Chromium. And that's the code that powers Google Chrome. The first one we're going to look at is a Brave privacy browser. I'm not going to go through all the information here, but Brave touts themselves as a privacy browser, and with an emphasis on privacy and ad blocking. But at the same time, they have this unique thing that's their own sort of thing, where you can earn cryptocurrency as you browse by looking at certain ads. And you get a lot more information on this if you go to the Wikipedia page on Brave, or if you go to their own website. The Cover Your Tracks tool reports strong protection against web tracking. And the browser has a feature called Shields, which blocks third-party tracking cookies and ads by default. Now, a lot of other browsers, you can go into the privacy settings and block third-party tracking cookies as well. So this isn't unique, but in most of the other browsers, you have to set this on your own. Brave forces HTTPS, which is the encrypted version of HTTP, and this same feature is common among a lot of other browsers, and the feature also allows you to choose between standard and aggressive tracker and ad blocking. Brave has advanced fingerprinting protection that randomizes the output of semi-identifying browser features. Now, fingerprinting, and we're going to talk about this more in another session on tracking, allows the trackers to identify you by the unique identifying characteristics of your computer, the programs you use, the cookies that are on it, and a lot of other things. And it's replacing cookies as the way that these outfits track you. Brave is also going to have their own private search engine for use with the browser. And they have another initiative called Sugarcoat, which is designed to thwart scripts that gather your browsing data while maintaining site functionality. So this is a way of getting around different trackers using JavaScript to track you and still have the websites functional. There's some more information you can go to on the Shield settings and using the Shields while browsing. And Brave is available for Android, iOS, Mac OS, and Windows. Mozilla Firefox, it's been around a long time. Mozilla's been at the forefront of trying to improve privacy on the web. And lately they've adopted that as a really distinguishing feature. And Firefox and its sister application, Thunderbird, are free to use. Mozilla appreciates donations to keep themselves going, but they don't monetize your information to make their money. Firefox is the first browser with a private browsing mode that can hide browsing not only from the people with access to your device, but from other sites. Because on a lot of the other browsers, the private mode doesn't protect you from other sites. Firefox is also the only major browser that includes tracking protection in its private browsing. Their enhanced tracking protection standard, which is built in, blocks social media trackers, cross-site tracking cookies, cross-site cookies, and a lot of other things. The Cover Your Tracks tool reports strong protection against web tracking with the setting turned on. And strict mode blocks trackers hidden in ads, videos, and other site content. Their fingerprinting protection currently uses a list of known fingerprint trackers, but they're working on a future update to make the browser look much more indistinguishable to thwart the fingerprinting. And there's other ways to thwart fingerprinting as well, and we'll cover this in a future thing when we look at tracking and ways to block it. Now, a lot of the browsers say that they collect anonymized metadata to help them make a better product. With Firefox, you can manually opt out of this data collection, but they don't make this really clear when you install it, and you have to go into your privacy settings to set this up. Firefox has a related product called Focus, which is a privacy-focused browser for iOS and Android that blocks ad trackers and has a built-in ad blocker. And Firefox is available for Android, iOS, Mac OS, Windows, and Linux. And there's a link here to with information on enhanced tracking protection for Firefox. Now, depending on which expert source you look up, look at it, it's a toss-up between Firefox and Brave for being the most private browser. Other browsers that we'll look at can get almost an equal level of privacy, but it's a lot more work with them. Now, DuckDuckGo, you might have heard of them. They provide a privacy-based search engine called DuckDuckGo, and they now have a standalone mobile web browser for Android and iOS. They're working on a desktop browser as well, but they're not quite there yet, and they haven't made any details public about how it'll handle things like fingerprinting. However, until the desktop browser does become available, they have a DuckDuckGo Privacy Essentials extension to turn your existing desktop browser, like Firefox, Google Chrome, whatever, into a privacy-focused piece of software. It blocks third-party trackers. It switches your search engine from Google Chrome and other search engines to the DuckDuckGo search engine. It forces sites to use the encrypted HTTPS connection or when it's available, and it lets you see a privacy score for sites you visit. The extension actually managed to raise Google Chrome score on the Cover Your Tracks tool to strong protection, which is saying something. DuckDuckGo is available, as previously mentioned, on Android and iOS, and its extension is available for Windows and the Apple products. Now, Microsoft Edge, we've had some back and forth on this over the last few months on whether it's a good browser or not, and there are a lot of different opinions across the spectrum on this. However, we're mainly focusing on privacy here, and Edge includes tracking protection with a choice of three levels: basic, balanced, and strict. Now, according to Edge, all levels block trackers we detect as crypto mining or fingerprinting. Now, crypto mining is something related to cryptocurrencies, and when I tried to figure it out and read the Wikipedia page on it, I just got more confused, so I won't comment on that. But there's no attempt to make this browser appear more generic to block fingerprinting and less identifiable as some of the other browsers do. But they also support what's called secure DNS, which to a certain extent blocks some of your targeted website addresses. Now, Edge does offer to personalize your advertising in Bing and Microsoft News. It does this by default, and you have to go in and turn it off by visiting your privacy dashboard to check the settings. And on the Cover Your Tracks test, Edge gets a rating of strong protection against web tracking, but indicates you still have a unique and therefore trackable fingerprint. Edge is available for Android, iOS, Linux, Mac OS, and Windows. And there's a link here to about more tracking prevention at Edge. The Avast Secure Browser, this is one of the few browsers that includes built-in VPN functionality, but it's paid-for software, unlike the other browsers. So unless you get it as part of the Avast Ultimate or the Avast One security packages, there are free alternatives. Now, I use the Avast Security Browser from time to time because I have one of the Avast security packages. And so me, the Avast Secure Browser was essentially a freebie. But if you go out and pay for it separately, it's there are better alternatives. The browser features built-in ad blocking, anti-phishing features, and a password manager. And that said, even though it's a secure browser, the default search provider is tracker-in-chief Google. But you can easily switch to a more private search provider like DuckDuckGo. It's very simple to do, and that's what I've done. to cover your tracks to a report's strong tracking protection, although with a unique traceable fingerprinting profile. And the VAST browser is available for Android, iOS, macOS, and Windows. Now there's Google Chrome. Google Chrome, in a lot of ways, is probably the most secure browser in terms of blocking malware, viruses, and that sort of stuff out of the box. I've been using Google Chrome for quite a while, and I can't say that my antivirus software has ever picked up anything coming through them. However, much of Google's business is based on tracking users. So Google Chrome out of the box is probably the worst at protecting your privacy, at least with its default settings. That said, as mentioned earlier, DuckDuckGo Privacy Essentials raised Google Chrome's score on the Cover Your Tracks tool to strong protection. So you can get Google Chrome to be relatively private if you try. If you still want to use Google Chrome or another browser that doesn't offer much tracking protection, there's other plugins available that might help protect your privacy, including the previously mentioned DuckDuckGo, Decentralize, Privacy Badger, or uBlock Origin. And you can get more information on any of these from Wikipedia as a sort of nonpartisan information source, or by going to the websites of these outfits. And Chrome is available for Android, Chrome OS, iOS, Linux, and Windows. And there's a link to an article here on increasing Chrome security and privacy. Now, I've got some pages here on the Tor browser, which isn't quite a browser in the standard sense. The Opera browser, Vivaldi, and Apple Safari. So if you download the deck, you can get a bit more information on these. Apple Safari is Apple's browser. So since this is the PC users group, we're not going to really look at that. And the other three are fairly specific browsers, not necessarily meant for the weak at heart, though they do have some very innovative features. And the Tor browser is probably one of the best around, but it can sometimes block a lot of the scripts and like JavaScript and make the web pages unusable. Some of the above descriptions I've just given have links for more information on privacy protection. This is really not enough. Those articles are fairly light, so you want to do a search for things like privacy settings or privacy extensions for the browser you're interested in. For example, do a search on Firefox privacy settings, and you'll get quite a few links. Take a look at a few of these links, but you can pretty much ignore the paid results at the top of the results search results page there, because they're trying to sell you something or take you somewhere. You can also use the previously mentioned browser plugins and extensions that may help protect your privacy. And in an upcoming Q&A session, we'll look at further at the search engine's privacy, some of the ways you can be tracked, and we'll look at anti-tracking and ad blocker software as well. And that'll more or less wrap up the series on privacy. So we can stop the share. Okay, and I'm done.
Okay, thanks very much, Bob.
Okay, before we carry on, I think I'd just comment that Pamela was having the issues with voice over IP. There are some comments in the chat, Pamela, the people saying what they use and why not. If I don't think we're going to have time this evening to go into it in more detail. So if you have anything to pass on to Pamela, by all means, shove it in the chat right now. And I think with that, we'll turn back to Alan to wrap up the evening.
Okay, thanks, Chris. The pre-meeting deck talked about a really good deal on membership. I just remind everybody, if you're not a member or you have friends and relatives who'd like to be a member, if you join right now, in fact, before March 31st of this year, and give us $20, we will give you 2 years membership rather than just one. So it's a 2-for-1 special. And I'll also remind you that if you are a existing member, then don't send us any money, because the board has decided to extend everybody's expiry dates for another year. And then looking forward, our January meeting will be next week, and Stefan is going to be talking about encryption, basic encryption, I guess, encryption 101. So that should be interesting. And of course, because it's a regular meeting, as Chris mentioned earlier, there will be no Q&A next week. So our next Q&A session will be in 2 weeks on January the 19th, which gives you lots of time to think up your questions and decide which topics you're going to share with everyone, and send your heads up to our suggestion box email address. And that's all I have. Thanks everyone for attending, and I'm going to wish you good night.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you at next week's general meeting and Q&A in 2 weeks.
And Chris will remember.